done recently by Jamie Kellogg and Stein Jacobson and Rick O'Connell, where they put a little extra spin on the box models by proposing a way that you could keep track of small-scale heterogeneities and the effects on those. And then I'll finish up with some brief comments on rare gases. So I'll start this by posing a question, and then we'll come back to this at the end, and I'll tell you why there are certain aspects of this picture that can't keep the batteries in contact with with the contacts. Okay. Why there's certain problems with this picture. Okay. Let's go over what we see from different perspectives. And this was actually in the overheads of the first lecture that I gave, but I didn't cover it. It's already on the website. So typical mantle that melts at mid-ocean ridges is not average mantle material, and we'll go over again why that's true. It's a little bit too depleted in these incompatible elements, the ones that plot on the left side of the spidergrams. It represents a relatively small fraction of the total mantle. Now, these numbers have been batted around quite a bit, and I'll explain to you why I think it's a relatively small percentage. It's something like the volume of the upper mantle above the 670 discontinuity, but it might even be smaller than that. And we'll show why it probably contains recycled material that's been mixed back into it. In other words, it's not just depleted residues from removing partial melts or removing the continental crust, but it's probably been remixed with some of this material along the way. Now, with mantle plumes, we think these bring up materials from depth. In general, they're different from the ambient upper mantle that's sampled at mid-ocean ridges. They consist of material that's not primitive. That is, it's usually less depleted than mid-ocean ridge basalts, but we'll look at that again. But it sometimes contains helium that looks primitive. And I say looks primitive because you can actually figure out a way to make it so that it's not primitive. But it's clearly associated with neodymium, strontium, lead, and hafnium that does not look primitive. Okay. Now, island arcs, if you look at where the material that melts in island arcs must come from, this either corner flow in the wedge or what's subducted, you would expect that they would sample the upper mantle too, a lot like mid-ocean ridge basalts do. And it looks isotopically like this is pretty much the case, except that there is some effect by subduction materials. Now, the reason that island arcs come into play is that when one tries to track the mantle back through time, you find that your mid-ocean ridge basalt analogs back in the geologic record are relatively few and far between. And in order to expand the database, you have to look at rocks that are interpreted as being ancient island arcs. Okay, so if you actually take what you see and say what you can about it, this is what the picture that I would draw, that the most highly depleted zones in the mantle, that in other words depleted in these incompatible elements that plot to the left of the spidergram plot, are these gray regions that I've pointed out here, which are underneath the ocean basins. We think that, you know, all those places you see blue underneath the continents at 150 kilometers in the S-wave tomography, those might be regions that are actually a little bit enriched in some of these things, at least relative to the average mantle. And the reason is that when you see basalts erupted in continental areas, like in the early stages of rifting, often they bring up material that looks a little bit enriched, and you see some evidence of it in ultramafic nodules that come up in these alkalic lavas as well. Now, the plumes may tell us nothing about anything else in the mantle except what's down at the bottom. So down at the bottom, we figure we must have recycled materials with helium-3 that's primitive that comes from somewhere. Okay, either it's a dense layer that's been there forever, or it comes out of the core, or you then have to create a region, a way to get it. Okay, really, we don't know what's in the middle because we may never see it. Now, one place you might see it is in a weak plume. If you can figure out a way to get the entrained material to melt a little bit, that's where you might see what's in the middle part of the mantle. And this has not been systematized. People have not been thinking in terms of what actually is melting in the plumes. And this is something I think it is worth revisiting.
What is the line?
This is the line that used to be at the 670, but after I edited the slide, it moved down. Okay, this is just to remind you about the relative masses of things, the lower mantle, the overall mantle being 400 times 10 to the 25 grams, the crust, continental crust being about 2. And for our box models, we'll find that the oceanic crust doesn't really count, because the oceanic crust comes out of the mantle and goes back down on a short enough time scale that it doesn't really count. Basically, it's part of the mantle. It's a sort, it's a vehicle, you know, like in biology, they have these electron shuttles. The oceanic crust may be a large ion lithophile element shuttle. It takes things out of the mantle, brings it to the subduction zone, and there you might stick it permanently into the continental crust or something. Okay, so here's our modern distribution of isotope ratios if we just look at neodymium and strontium. And we'll look at this histogram a couple of times. And first of all, so this is basically the global MORB data set. I don't think it's weighted in any particular way, but I can't remember now what this is out of the Kellogg et al. Paper. And you can see that the average value for the epsilon ND value is about plus 10, and we'll go over this in a minute. And then the ocean island basalts are the mean value is shifted significantly, what, about three or four units. Towards zero, which would be the bulk earth chondritic value. And it's got a distribution that's got a longer and more substantial tail on it. Okay, so it looks a bit more heterogeneous than what's sampled at MORBS. And of course, what's sampled at MORBS also includes stuff that may come up in the same way that ocean islands form. So, but there's clearly a difference between them, okay? And this one, but the two important characteristics are they're both on the plus side of zero. So only this stuff, this little bit of the tail over here that's below zero looks enriched. That is, it's more enriched in the incompatible elements and samarium, neodymium kind of tracks them than everything else. Well, than the unmodified mantle. Okay, now, if you want to go back through time, you can go back to the Cretaceous, early Cretaceous, by looking at oceanic basalts, mid-ocean ridge basalts. But if you want to go back through most of Earth history, you have to look at old rocks. So here, this is from a paper by I think Favort and Jana Blickert-Toft that summarizes where the old rocks are on the continents. And the Archean rocks, which go back beyond 2.5 billion years, are these dark areas, and the rest of Proterozoic, which expands between about 600 million years and about 2.5 billion years. And so this is where you have to look. Now, it turned out that the data that are in the literature are not evenly spread out over this whole area. They tend to be in a few places that have been favorite places for people, like West Greenland, the Canadian Shield, South Africa, Western Australia, and a couple of other places. Okay. Now, when you go back and look at these older rocks, you're faced with a geological problem and a petrological problem. What are they? So you see some basalts in the geologic record, and the question is, how did they form? Are they mid-ocean ridge type basalts? Are they plume basalts? Are they island arc basalts? And this is where a lot of geological input and intuition has to go in. Okay, now here's an example of what we're going to look at and try to understand. This is the initial epsilon ND values of these rocks that have been identified as ocean floor type rocks in the geologic record going back almost to 4 billion years. Now plotted at this end, I've got the the sort of plus or minus one standard deviation range of mid-ocean ridge basalts and what you see in primitive island arcs like in the Western Pacific. Okay. So these numbers span a bit of a range. The average value we think for MORBS is about 10, and the average value for primitive arcs is about 8 or so on this scale. And then as you go back through time, you see that these things march back towards zero, and presumably everything started out back here with a value of zero because you accreted the Earth out of chondritic materials. There's controversy over the fact that there's a big range back here up to over 4 in these rocks that are 3.75 or 3.8 billion years old, and some people think that these rocks, these numbers are unreliable and they're a little bit too high, but there are clearly numbers that are up around 2.5 or so back here. So you were able to get off the zero line up to here, then it didn't look like it. You went up very much for a while, and then you've been marching up gradually since then. Okay, yeah, so this is an interpretation of the people who wrote this paper. They don't like these points. There must be something wrong with them. And there's some arguments for why there might be something wrong with them. Okay. That's Favert and Blickertoft, and it's... So I have to switch to overheads now. So we'll put this guy to sleep. And I think someone may have to turn off the... Okay, so our Earth evolution models start out with a picture, a cartoon that looks like this. Why did that shift to being a little bit darker? Okay, so this would be a reasonably general version of the model. So we have continental crust. This is a long-lived reservoir where things are stored for long periods of time. The upper mantle, the lower mantle, you can pick your volumes for the two or masses for the two. We assign each one a mass. This would be the crustal mass, the upper mantle mass, the lower mantle mass. And then we would think of mass being exchanged between these reservoirs. So the exchange between the lower and the upper mantle is a small m here with the subscript LU saying that's the mass going from the lower to the upper mantle. This is the mass flux going from the upper mantle to the lower mantle. Upper mantle to the crust, and crust back to the upper mantle. Okay. If you want to, you can put another arrow here that takes continental crust and puts it right back down in the lower mantle. That would be another wrinkle that you could put in the model. Okay, now, for radiogenic isotopes, the only thing that matters is if you separate the parent isotope from the daughter isotope chemically. So if you can change the ratio between the two somewhere along the line here, you can have some effect on the isotope ratios. If you had no fractionation from parent from daughter, then no matter what you did here, all the reservoirs would have the same isotope ratio for all time, because they would always have the same parent to daughter ratio, and the parent would be decaying to the daughter, so they would track each other. They'd all be changing an isotope ratio with time, but they'd all be the same. Where we think the main fractionation comes is in forming continental crust. We know that continental crust has different parent-daughter ratios, has high rubidium strontium, has low samarium neodymium, and so on, low lutetium hafnium ratio. So this is where the chemical fractionation occurs, and so you tend to store stuff up here that has a different parent-to-daughter ratio. This means that the material that's left down in the mantle has to have a complementary parent-daughter ratio on the other side of the bulk earth value. And because they are different, they're going to evolve different isotope ratios with time. And if you mix them back together, that fanning out of isotope ratios is going to be attenuated because you're exchanging stuff back and forth. So the question is, given different fluxes, how much different can the isotopic composition of the continental crust be from the upper mantle? How much different can the upper mantle be from the lower mantle? And this will give us some handle on how much material per unit time is being exchanged between the reservoirs. I have this in a bad place relative to the fan here, so I'm going to put it down here. Okay, just to remind you quickly, one of the reasons that we like to use samarium neodymium for this is illustrated here, and this will also get you used to the, well, again, show you that I like to do the geological thing and plot age here with zero on the left and age increasing to the right. That makes time go to the left. Okay. If you look at the uranium lead system, Stan talked about this. If you track between the solar nebula, the accretion, condensation and accretion process, and core formation, what happened, the net result was you ended up making a much higher uranium to lead ratio in the silicate portion of the Earth. And the silicate portion of the Earth now plots way up here with a high 206, 204. The solar nebula value and the chondritic values and presumably the core all plot down here. Okay, so it's because of the big fractionation, it's a little bit hard to know exactly what the uranium to lead ratio is, but as Stan pointed out, you know something else about the lead system. Because of the fact that there's big fractionation here, the uranium lead system dates the formation of and the time of these events, and so we know the time of the Earth's formation and core formation relatively well. It has to be back there near 4.5 billion years. For rubidium strontium, it's the other way around. The solar nebula has a high rubidium to strontium ratio, so the 87-86 ratio increases very rapidly. When you form the Earth from it, it ends up with a low ratio of rubidium to strontium and evolves off this way. And so, once again, we can use rubidium strontium to date the Earth, but on the other hand, we are a little bit uncertain what the bulk Earth value is because of this big fractionation. For samarium neodymium, the idea is that the solar nebula, the condensation accretion process, and core formation had no effect whatsoever. Everything ended up unfractionated and in the mantle of the Earth, and consequently, the only thing that's affected samarium neodymium is the formation of continents, things going on inside the planet since the planet formed. So it filters out all this other stuff, and we can just look at the mass balances between the reservoirs and the Earth. So the general idea is that if you start out with something that represents this chondritic type reservoir, it's moving along this line here that corresponds to the evolution or the accumulation of 143 neodymium relative to 144 due to the samarium decay. And because it's such a long half-life, it's approximately a straight line. And if at some time you partially melt part of the mantle, you take it out and make some kind of volcanic crust, because we know how partial melting works, we know that this volcanic crust will have a low ratio of samarium to neodymium, and it'll evolve this way down to here, and then this depleted material will evolve up to here. Immediately after you do this, when you're just after T1 here, there's very little isotopic variation in the system, and you need to let it grow in with the different samarium to neodymium ratios over periods that are a large fraction of the age of the Earth in order to get any substantial isotopic variation. So the slopes of these lines, the rate of change is just proportional to the samarium to neodymium ratio, and we know how this behaves, at least in a general sense with regard to partial melting in the mantle. Now, just to review briefly the epsilon notation, if we take this plot that we just had of age versus 143, 144, this would be the chondritic ratio. If we were gradually taking crustal material out of the depleted part of the mantle is acquiring a higher and higher samarium to neodymium ratio. So its epsilon value diverges from the chondritic value in the positive way. And at each point in time, when we take crustal material out of the mantle, it starts from the isotope ratio that the mantle has and evolves off on a lower slope. Now, what we've done with the epsilon notation is just to subtract out the chondritic evolution here and just look at the differences between these things, and it looks like this then. The depleted mantle starts out at zero here and evolves up toward positive values, and at various times crust is derived from it, starts out with a positive value, and then ends up with a negative value down here. Okay, and then we've got names for these model ages so that we can actually measure pieces of the crust. We can extrapolate back to where we think the depleted mantle is and tell when that material actually was extracted from the mantle. So the idea of reconstructing the isotopic evolution curve of the Earth is diagrammed here. So when we look at the continents, they're made up of chunks of different ages. Some are very old, some are younger, different ages, these are billions of years, and you've got new continental crust, which presumably is being formed in island arcs, and that's telling you what you're seeing today. So what we would find in these old rocks was we'd have measured neodymium 143-144 ratios that were lower than the mid-ocean ridge basalts and other oceanic basalts. We have to correct for the age and samarium neodymium ratio back to some value over here, and this corrected value, which is called the initial value, is something that we're going to compare to the chondritic curve to tell us what the mantle was doing, what characteristics the mantle had in the past. Okay, since I've got these transparencies, I'm going to throw them up here so that we can, Stan talked about this a little bit. The original spidergrams only had rare earth elements in them, and the reason that, well, it was because with rare earths, people decided that they could measure them very well back in the 60s, and the only difference between the light rare earths and the heavy rare earths, since they typically all had a valence of plus 3, was in ionic radius, and the ones on the left were larger ions than the ones on the right, so they're more incompatible in the mantle minerals than the ones on the right. And then later on, this fellow Thompson, what was his first name, Bob? Robert Thompson? It was Thompson that made the first spidergram. He didn't really do much else that was of note, but he invented these spidergrams, and people have just conveniently forgot about the fact that he invented them because of maybe he wasn't just a sufficiently likable character. But people then started to add things to the left side of the diagram that were more incompatible, and add things to the right side that were less incompatible. And then they started to add things in between the rare earth elements too, because they were sort of in between incompatibilities. So the spidergrams grew out of these original rare earth element plots. And this is what the distribution coefficients look like. And here's orthopyroxene. Here's olivine this is about 15 years old, and at the time there was a proposal that olivine probably actually looked like this, but you couldn't measure these low concentrations because whenever you tried to do it, your analysis was contaminated by the liquid that you were, or glass that you were trying to analyze. So at any rate, what you can see is that all these elements have retained samarium a little bit more than neodymium, olivine, orthopyroxene, and garnet has a whopping big effect. It's a huge difference between the heavy rare earth elements and light rare earth elements, and that's why the presence or absence of garnet in the mantle during melting has a big effect on these elements. And amphibole and clinopyroxene, well, clinopyroxene is important as well, and you can see it also retains samarium more than neodymium. So when you take the average of these things weighted by their proportions in the rock and you melt it, then that gives you the bulk distribution coefficient, and you can calculate what the rare earth pattern is going to look like. Pardon? This is an interesting feature. Europium is the only one of the rare earth elements that actually commonly has two valence states, and one of them is plus 2. And if you're sufficiently reduced, you have enough in the plus 2 state, and then it substitutes very well for calcium. And consequently, in plagioclase, which is a calcium mineral, it ends up having an anomalously high concentration. This is useful because it's a signature for the presence of plagioclase. When plagioclase precipitates out of basaltic magmas, you end up with a lava that has a depletion in your opiate. And we'll see its effect actually in a minute, because one thing I left out of the outline was that I'm going to mention the magma ocean business a little bit. And you can actually see the effect of plagioclase crystallization and lunar basalts from the magma ocean. Okay, so here's one of these reduced spidrograms with just the rare earth elements in it. This is the concentration divided by the concentration in the original solid. So we're starting out with, let's say, in this case, garnet lairzolite on the left, which would have everything along one at the starting point, and then we melt at 1%, 10%, and 30%. Now, depending on how much you melt it, you have different residual minerals left in the source, and you have to take that into consideration, and this is just for batch melting. So the 1% melt looks like this. It's very fractionated. You've got a large increase in the light rare earth elements and not so much in the heavies. And you can see the samarium-neodymium ratio is such that the SM is lower than the ND. And this alpha is the ratio of the SM-ND ratio in the liquid here, the calculated liquid relative to the start. So it's decreased by about 35%. And as you increase the melting, this goes closer and closer to no fractionation, because with 30% melt, almost all the rare earths are in the liquid. So all you've done is gotten back what you started with in terms of the pattern, but everything's enriched by 1 over F. So if you melt 1%, you get a residue that has about a 15% higher SMND ratio. And if you melt more than that, you get up to 50%. So for 1 to 10%, you get SMND ratios that are 15 to 50% higher than the chondritic value. Okay, for spinel pyritotite, where you don't have the garnet present, you get a little bit less fractionation for these different amounts of melting. But in general, when you melt the mantle, you're left with something that has a high samarium to neodymium ratio, and you make a liquid that has a low SMND ratio. Now, how do these correspond to changes in epsilon ND? Well, let's say you did this exercise of melting the garnet pyritotite back at 3.8 billion years ago, and you had 1% melt, a little bit that was 10% melted, and some that was 30% melted. If you let it evolve for 4 billion years, or 3.8, you'll end up with epsilon values that are between about 13 or 14 for the 1% melt, up to about plus 50 for 10% melt. Now, when you actually look at the range that you see, which is from about minus 4 to plus 12, you see that you don't see any of these things that are way up here in the plus 20 to plus 50 range, and this must be significant. If you did the same exercise and you did it only 1 billion years ago, you would pretty much cover the range that you're seeing in oceanic basalts. So there's two possibilities. One is everything that you're seeing in mid-ocean ridge, in oceanic basalts today, are depletion events that happened fairly recently. Or if you did it a long time ago and you had these reservoirs that were heading up here toward the 20s and 30s, you somehow stirred them with things that were down here in the negative region or near zero, so that you brought them back toward zero again. Okay, so this, I think, is a significant piece of information. Now, Stan, by the way, said that he did models for these based on an age of about whatever it was, 2 or 1.7 billion years, right? So that will mean that you, to get up here to the plus 10, if you do a few percent melting at 1.7 billion years ago, you'll get up there. Trick is, if you push it back any further, then you get, you know, numbers that you just don't see. Okay, so now let's do the material balance thing, and then we'll get to the actual transport models. So there's several constraints that you get from material balance. We know that the bulk Earth has an epsilon value of zero. I'm not going to go through the justification for that again, but let's just take it for given for the time being. So that means that if we add up the sum of the product of the masses of the different reservoirs in the Earth, their neodymium concentrations and their epsilon values, they have to add to zero. So at first, let's do a simple thing. Let's assume there's only two reservoirs. There's continental crust and there's depleted mantle or upper mantle in our model. and that these two things are complementary. Everything else then has an epsilon of zero, we're going to assume. So this is not a good assumption, but we'll see how this comes out. So when we rearrange this equation, we get that the mass of the upper mantle, the ratio of the upper mantle mass to the crustal mass, is just the ratio of the concentrations times the ratio of the epsilon values. Okay, so what we're going to do in a minute when I switch back to the computer is we're going to go into the germ database and we're going to look up these numbers and see how variable they are. So if I look at the germ database, I could pick a number something like 20 or 22 ppm for the concentration of neodymium in the crust. And for the depleted mantle, the present-day upper mantle will be something like 0.8 ppm. So this ratio is about 30, or a little less than 30. And the average crustal rock has a value of about minus 15. And the upper mantle, let's say, has a value of epsilon of 10, which is the Morb value. So 1.5 times a little less than 30 gives you a number something like 40. So if the mass of the crust is a little less than 2 times 10 to the 25 grams, then the mass of the upper mantle in this region, in this calculation, is about 80 times 10 to the 25 grams. So the mass of the material above 670 is something like 100, or a little bit less than 100 times 10 to the 25 grams. So this is a crude way to do this material balance, where you come out with the crust balancing the amount of depleted mantle that would cover the upper part of the present-day mantle. Now, you actually have more constraints than that, and there's a better way to do this. Not only do the epsilon values have to equal zero, but when you add up the samarium-neodymium ratios, they also have to equal zero. And let me go to another. I'm going to use this notation, but I haven't really introduced it yet. So let me pluck this out. We're going to come back to this, but let me just show you this now, and then we'll go over it again when we get to it. When we get to the transport model, we're going to come up with this equation, basically, where the epsilon value, the change with time, is got a radioactive decay part and then a exchange part between the reservoirs. And we can boil it down to numbers that we can call Q and F. Now, Q is basically a replacement for the radioactive decay constant and has, it has a bunch of constants in it. I've got it in one of the overheads, I guess. It comes out to have a value of about 25 billion years to the minus 1, and F is the difference between the samarium-neodymium ratio of the reservoir you're talking about and the chondritic ratio, minus 1. So if this value is equal to 0, then the SMND value is equal to the chondritic value. And if it's equal to 0.25, then you've got a samarium-neodymium ratio that's 25% higher than the chondritic value. And then this will be a recycling constant or parameter that we'll get to in a bit. Okay, so the other conservation, where did I shuffle that transparency to? So because the samarium-neodymium ratio of the Earth has to be equal to chondritic, stupid thing. This also has to be the case that the mean F value has to be zero. The masses, of course, of the reservoirs have to add up to what you started with, and also the concentration of neodymium has to be the concentration in the bulk silicate earth, whatever that is. So you end up then with this relationship between the ratio between the upper mantle and the crust, and the concentration ratio between the crust and the upper mantle. And the initial mantle, this is the bulk silicate earth value, and you've got the values here of the mean age of the crust and the epsilon value in the upper mantle and the F value for the crust. So this number we know pretty well, this number we know pretty well, and this number you can get out of the database. So if you look up these numbers in the germ database, you get concentrations for the bulk crust of between 16 and 27 ppm. You get concentrations for the bulk silicate earth between 1.06 and 1.45. You get F value for the crust between minus 0.3 and minus 0.4. And then I mentioned this value is 25 billion years to the minus 1. You now have access to the PETDB database and use it, and you've got also this summary that Sue did. So you can decide what the average value in mid-ocean ridge basalts is by doing what you want to that database. Some people are arguing that 10 isn't the right number, that it should be a number like 8. But you can decide if you want to average by length of the ridge or just look at the places with no hot spots or whatever you want to do, you can decide what that number is. The mean age of the crust is about 2 billion years. There's a number of ways that you can get at that. And the average values probably can't be much less than that. It could be as low as about 1.9 or 1.8. And it can't be much older than about 2.2. So anyway, if you put those numbers in, you can generate a graph that looks like this. Okay. So you put the numbers in that I just gave you, and take the ratio of the concentration in the crust to the mantle as 20, you'll get a number of 54 for the ratio of the upper mantle mass to the crustal mass, and that's about 100 times 10 to the 25 grams. If you plot it up, the mass of the Morb reservoir versus the age of the continental crust, you get this diagram so you can evaluate what changing the epsilon value in Morb would matter, what changing the mean age of the continental crust would be. But if you take the mean age of the crust and take the mean value for Morb of about plus 10, you get a number for the mass of depleted mantle, which accidentally or whatever is roughly the mass up here. Now, the other thing that you can use this mass balance relationship for that you can't argue about is what's the mean epsilon value of the total mantle? If we know the mean value of the crust and how much neodymium is in the crust, this you can't argue with, and it comes out to be plus 2. So this shows the diagram here. If you want to have the whole mantle balance the crust, its epsilon value should be plus 2. Now, one thing you can't argue with is that plus 2 is not a number that's common in oceanic basalts. When you look at that distribution, they're all up in the plus 5 to plus 12 range, even with the, or plus 4 to plus 12 range, even with the oceanic island basalts. So no matter what you do, nothing we see in oceanic basalts is, you know, concentrating around plus 2. And that number, you can't change. That's a pretty hard number. Okay. So, by the way, when I did this, there's a lot of other stuff in the literature, by the way, that says that this mass balance is wrong, that it's not 25% of the mantle, it's something much larger. I don't know where they got the numbers from, to tell you the truth. Yeah, I know, but if you look up it's because people have used extraordinary high values for the neodymium concentration of the crust, and they've used extraordinarily fractionated SMND values for the crust. And there's no way to defend those numbers. The concentration of neodymium in the crust is not as high as those people have. If you double it, of course, you double it. No, it's not what I use 24 or something like that, but the actual values that are in the latest compilation are 16 and 20 ppm. Okay. Well, you can go to the papers that argue them. It's Rudnick and Fountain and some other ones, and Taylor and McLennan.
Going in,
No, that's not right. Because, first of all, strontium doesn't help. You don't know what a bulk earth is. And the concentration ratios are even less well known for strontium. I don't see how you can... I don't think it's a debatable point. I think if you want to make other enriched reservoirs other than the crust, you can do it, but you can't... Okay, so this is not the first first overhead in this. Okay, so if you want to treat the time resolution, you can find the development of these models in a number of papers going back to about 1980. You write conservation equations for three isotopes. So you're going to have a radioactive isotope, it's going to have a concentration, this would be the number of atoms in the reservoir, a radiogenic isotope, which I called I with a star, and some other isotope, which I just called I, and you write the differential form, what sum the fluxes into and out of the reservoir, the change in the number of number of atoms of this species in the reservoir with time, are the fluxes in minus the fluxes out. And for the stable isotope, you'll get, for the upper mantle, what's coming in from the lower mantle, the mass flux times the concentration in the lower mantle, the mass flux from the crust times the concentration in the crust, and you're losing the mass flux from the upper mantle to the lower mantle times whatever's in the upper mantle, and you're losing to the crust a mass flux times the concentration in the mantle modified by an enrichment coefficient, which is a number that you have to decide. You'll have the same thing then for the radioactive isotope down here, and it will have a different enrichment factor for making the crust, and you have to set these enrichment factors so that you get the right concentrations in the crust and the right ratio of the parent to daughter. And then for the radioactive species, you have one other term, which is a decay constant, modifying the amount that's in the reservoir. And then for the radiogenic species, you have another term, which is the amount that's coming from the radioactive parent. Okay. Right. The problem with it is that we know that the crust doesn't form by a simple one-stage partial melting. So in order to do the transfer in a realistic way, you have to use numbers that will give you the right crustal composition. Okay. So again, we'll start with the simplest model and then we'll do the modification to it. The simplest model would be we'll just deal with the upper part of the mantle for the time being and ignore the lower part of the mantle, and then we'll add in exchange between the upper and the lower part of the mantle. So you need a fair amount of algebra. I've done this recently. It took about 7 pages of algebra to take into account all the transformations to the epsilon notation, use all the mass conservation constraints and everything. And then you get this relatively simple form where the change in the epsilon value of the upper mantle with time is due to the fact that it has a different SMND value than the chondritic. So its F value here times this modified decay constant minus a term that has a recycling coefficient multiplied by the actual epsilon value. Okay, so these are what these numbers are. This recycling coefficient is the ratio of the mass flux down from the crust to the crust. So this is the fraction of the continental crust that's returned to the mantle per unit time, divided by the fraction of the initial neodymium that's still left in the upper mantle. So if the mantle is depleted by about a factor of 2 in neodymium in the upper part, then this is just the ratio of the mass flux to the mass of the crust times 2. Okay. So if you add exchange between the upper and the lower mantle, you get a second coefficient. So you'll have a lambda nd plus lambda prime nd here, multiplying epsilon. And that will mean that some of your modulation or attenuation of the epsilon growth of the mantle can come from exchange with the lower mantle. All right, now if you just look at the upper part of this diagram. So if we track the evolution of the mantle epsilon value with time starting from the beginning, the net change with time in the isotope ratio is due to a radioactive decay term, which is making it go this way, and a recycling term, which is making it go that way. So if we can, and since we can take the, we have some data, if we plug in numbers for the value and the slope, we know this, the change in the epsilon with time, and we know this, and then if we can figure out what this is, and this will basically be a function of the of how much crust you made, then you can calculate how much recycling you have to do. So in terms of the these data for the crustal evolution, this was the 1988 version in the book that I did in 1988, where I selected things that I thought might be representative of depleted mantle. Looks pretty much like a straight line between 0 back here and plus 10 up here. This is all the data that you could find on various things. You can see a lot of them plot below this line, and the explanation would be that they're not purely derived from depleted mantle, but they have some other older crustal components in them. So at the time, the neodymium, so this is what were the fits that I used to these curves. And they give the numbers of the value of epsilon and the slope. And this is what the hafnium data looked like at the time. They were fairly sparse. They looked a little different, and that looked interesting. Since then, they've changed, and now they look exactly like the neodymium data. And then the newer version looks like this, the 2000 version for both neodymium and hafnium. And you can see that one of the differences is that you've got a straight line here, but they've got this stuff that started out, that got up to pretty high values fast, and then there's this plateau in here. So if you take this stuff all at face value and fit that line, you get, let me get to that top part thing, this kind of graph. This is what, so there's two things that you have to, one thing you have to specify is the growth of the mass of the continental crust. And so Stein-Jacobson did this, and this is what he got. For a crustal growth curve, he grows the crust rapidly between the beginning of the Earth and about 3.8, at which time he has the full mass that we have today. And then he keeps the mass constant, and he does the rest by recycling. And in order to get that plateau, where you have no change in the epsilon value, even though radioactive decay is driving you up that way, you have to have a lot of recycling. So he gets a large recycling rate for the crust between 3.6 and 2 billion years, and then it comes down to a number like 0.2 or 0.25 crustal masses per billion years are being recycled. Okay. Okay, we can say a little bit about the growth of continents based on this concept. If there's no recycling of the continents back to the mantle, then the mantle, the equation for the mantle looks like this. Now, the amount that the mantle is fractionated is roughly proportional to the mass of the continents that you make. So if the continents grew linearly, you could substitute here something like k times t, and then when you integrated it, you would get the epsilon value went like t squared. And that would then give you a growth curve for epsilon that would look something like this, that it would start be very close to zero for the first half of Earth history and would only have grown larger values in the later part. And most people argue that this doesn't really look like the data. The data look like they get up here pretty fast and then they come along here along a straight line. So you can't have you can't fit the data very well with a model where you delay making the crust until fairly recently. So you do much better off if you make the crust early, which then gets you out here, and then you start recycling it in order to keep you on a trajectory that's appropriate. Just to show you some actual calculations that I did a long time ago. This is just another version with slightly different notation up here, but this shows the epsilon evolution here. These are different models for the growth of the crust. This one's the stepwise one, number two, where you grow it in pulses through Earth history. One is linear growth, and three is a lot of it early, and then gradual growth later on. No recycling at all. And these are the evolution curves that you get for 1, 2, and 3. Okay, they're actually not all that much different, and the data sort of fit in between them. And as you go to a straighter evolution curve like this, you get crust that has an older and older average age, and then the complementary mass of the mantle material changes as well, from something like 100 times 10 to the 25 grams up to 160. Okay, so if you put in exchange between the upper and lower mantle, when you recycle continents into the upper mantle, you're recycling material that has a very high concentration of neodymium, and it has an isotopic composition which is a lot different from the mantle. Okay, so it really has a big effect to put a little bit back in and stir it in. If you take material from the lower part of the mantle, which is either undepleted or less depleted, and put it into the upper mantle via plumes or whatever, or broad flow, that material has a slightly higher neodymium concentration, maybe 50% higher, and it has an epsilon value which is only a little bit different than the upper mantle, so it has a lot less effect per unit mass. So the recycling coefficient, the ratio of the one that represents exchange with the lower mantle to the crustal recycling coefficient, basically is a ratio of the mass flux from the lower mantle to the crust, compared to the mass flux from the crust, and the ratio of the neodymium concentrations. And you can put it in terms of the maximum would be the concentration of neodymium in the bulk silicate earth versus the concentration in the crust, and then you have a factor that evaluates the difference in the isotope ratios, and I put 2 in here, but it could be as much as 4. Okay, so when you plug these numbers in, you get that the ratio of the lambdas is going to be about 1/40th or 1/50th times the ratio of the mass fluxes. So since the mass of the crust today is about 2 times 10 to the 25 grams, if the recycling constant is 0.25, that is about a half times 10 to the 25 grams per billion years. So you need the mass flux from the lower mantle to be 20 or 25 times 10 to the 25 grams per gigayear in order to have as much neodymium coming up in order to get as much of an effect from lower mantle exchange as you do from crustal recycling. So how big is 20 times 10 to the 25 grams? Well, the Hawaiian plume flux is probably something like 1.5 of these units. So you need about, 15 Hawaiian plumes would bring enough material up. The oceanic lithosphere generation rate is about 65 times 10 to the 25 grams per gigayear. So this is, if all that stuff's going down through the 670-kilometer discontinuity, that would mean that's another estimate of how much exchange is going on. That would be plenty to do this, okay? But it would mean you'd have to have an efficiency of about 30%. About 1/3 of the material going down subduction zones would have to make it through the 670 into the lower mantle. Now, even at that, you would then have an effect from lower mantle exchange, which is only equal to the effect from recycling continental crustal material into the mantle. Okay. Now, if you look back to the first lecture at the list that Al Hoffman gave of, what are the sources of heterogeneity in the mantle, he points out that recycling crust is a small mass flux, okay? And he shows that, recycling continental or oceanic lithosphere or oceanic crust are much larger fluxes, okay? This is true, but the fact is that in terms of how much isotope effect that they have, their ability to shift the isotope ratios in the upper mantle, they're still about equal. And so there's probably an effect. So those recycling rates are probably overestimates for how much crust is being recycled, but maybe only by a factor of 2, something like that. Now, as our discussion between Stan and I illustrated before, there isn't general agreement on exactly, what the best fit to all of this data would be, okay? Now, let me mention this because I've been concerned about this issue for a long time. If you do the same thing for strontium that you do for neodymium, do the same kind of construct, what you find with the available strontium data on old rocks is that they don't fit the model the same way that the neodymium and the hafnium data do. So if you do it in terms of just the isotope ratio rather than the epsilon value, if you start from the meteorite value back here, the bulk earth should be up here at 7045. Stan said 7047, that's not a whole lot different. So that should be your bulk earth value. It looks like the neodymium diverges from the bulk earth value along a linear trend. And strontium, because it's partitioned about the same as neodymium between the crust and the mantle, should do about the same thing. So it should be linear from here to where it is at mid-ocean ridge basalts today, which is 7025 or 7026. Okay. So if you look, so the neodymium data sort of follow this trend pretty well, but the strontium data sort of don't change the initial values back to about 2 billion years, and then they follow the bulk earth curve. So this ain't what you would expect, okay? And if you wanted to do something, well, let me show you on the epsilon value, which epsilon curve, which is a little bit easier to evaluate. Okay. So the epsilon curve, if the strontium looked like the epsilon curve for neodymium, it'd follow this black line. It also would be for the same for hafnium. So basically, you're in the right place down here, and you've ended up in the right place. Okay, but when you go back into the middle part of the Earth history, none of the numbers are in the right place. The numbers as measured are the black dots. The open symbols are an improvement that you can make by arguing that the initial isotope ratio of the Earth was not the achondrite value down at 699, but something higher because there was late accretion of chondritic material that have high 87-86 ratio. So you bumped up the initial value of the mantle, so you change the evolution curve that corresponds to bulk Earth. So what most people have done is ignore these data, because the problem is that it's very difficult to find old rocks where you can measure the strontium and get a reliable initial isotope ratio. The alternative interpretation is that they're telling us something. There was something substantially different about what was going on with the early crust in the first 2 billion years than what's been going on since 2 billion years ago. And an example of how you can possibly explain this is that if the early crust of the Earth was much more basaltic, you could still get a fairly large SMND fractionation, but it might not be fractionated very much with regard to RBSR. And then if you fairly rapidly change the average composition of the continents from basaltic to more granitic over a period of time here in the mid-history of the Earth, then you could potentially explain some of this.
Change the bulk earth structure to make that curve.
Actually, I didn't change the bulk earth. I changed the initial value, and I'll show you. Yeah, I'll show you on this. It's on this diagram. So I ran it up basically another five or six in the fourth decimal place here, which at the time when people were sold on Alex Halliday and incorrect data, looked like it might be just possible to do this. Okay, but for people, most people's models, this is difficult to do. There's another reason why this is difficult to do, and that is that, although people have said that there's an argument around this, but if you want to get the Earth from the Moon, the Moon from the Earth, by a large impact early on, which is supposed to happen way back here around 4.5 or something like that, okay, then the Moon, you can measure the initial values of isotope ratios in lunar rocks, and they're way down here. They're pretty much, barely higher than the achondrite values, okay. So if you got the Earth running up this way, it's very difficult to get the Moon from it if you do that. So the only other way you can do that is to get the Moon first and then lay on this radiogenic stuff after the Moon goes. I guess that's a possibility. Yeah, they go up to 4.5 essentially. High 4.4s anyway, I can't remember exactly. Yeah. Okay, as usual, using up a lot more time than I was anticipating. Let me show you this, because this is kind of neat. This calculation is in this book that I did in 1988. Nobody ever pays any attention to it, but it's interesting. What would happen if you did the magma ocean thing? And actually, I put this in the book partly because back in the 80s, Don Anderson's thing was explaining all the isotope data with the magma ocean effects. Okay, so I put this in there for Don Anderson. He went on to other things, okay, but I still think he thinks that you could explain the isotope data by a magma ocean. If you look at the Moon, and people have done these calculations for what you would get if you fractionally crystallize a bulk lunar composition, and Anne Hoffmeister did this for her PhD thesis, actually, or shortly thereafter. This is what you get in the residual material that's crystallizing out. Once you start out by crystallizing, I can't remember what you start out with. You have a relatively low pressure situation on the Moon. So, at some point you start crystallizing plagioclase. So where you have plagioclase crystallizing, you have rocks in the Moon that have positive europium anomalies. And then the last liquid that's left is depleted in europium because of the crystallization of plagioclase. And then the way you make the lunar surface be mostly, you know, light-colored white rocks is to float this plagioclase up to the surface, and you end up with a crust that's made up largely of plagioclase. So, but you can make predictions then about what the range of SMND value should be in the lunar mantle beneath the crust, and then the Mauri basalts were produced by melting those at about 3.3 to 3.9 billion years ago. And when you predict what you should get for isotope evolution of the various parts of the Moon, particularly the parts between 60 and 198% solidified, you get this range of evolution curves. And when you look at the Mauri basalt data, that's where they are. Okay. So for SMND, the magma ocean hypothesis fits the data. Actually, a lot of other things fit the data as well. And the reason is probably the Moon went dead, essentially, after 3.3 billion years, and there was no way to rehomogenize this stuff. So it was frozen in. Actually, it went dead probably earlier than that, and there was no way to freeze that in. If you do the same exercise for the Earth, Anne Hoffmeister did two possibilities. One was for a Lherzolite mantle, and one was for a more olivine-poor, pyroxene-rich mantle, which she called the picritic. There's actually a word for that, which is called olivine-websterite, but Don Anderson made up this term, picklogite, which substitutes for olivine websterite. Anyway, if you do it for the Earth, for the Laird's light model, you get this. So from if you look at the SMND evolution, from 0 to 50% solidified, you go along this line. From 50 to 70%, 75% solidified, you get this whole range up here. And then the last bit comes out down here. So basically, all the data plot in the window where you wouldn't expect any to be. And none of them plot up here where a substantial part of the upper part of the mantle should be fractionated in this case. So this, in other words, there should be very large variability in the mantle generated by fractional crystallization by a magma ocean that you don't see. And if you look at the picklogite model, it's worse. You get much more fractionation in this model. This probably needs to be redone if we know the phase mineralogy any better now. And here you get all of the rocks either plotting up in this range here with huge positive epsilon values or down with negative epsilon values. You don't get any plotting where the data plot. So I thought that this was, you know, pretty nice evidence that whatever we're seeing in the mantle has very little to do with the original magma ocean. Okay, so let me just go back to my, if you turn that on, I can finish in 2 minutes here. I was hoping this was going to be a shorter talk, but it didn't turn out that way, did it? Oh, it has to warm up. Okay. So the last bit that I wanted to mention, I'm going to have to skip the Kellogg et al. Thing. Okay. Okay, so if we go, I'll go back to this first. This is where the data plot for the oceanic basalts, this is where the bulk mantle should be. If you use the data that are available for the average values of the bulk earth and the continental crust, this is where the bulk mantle should be. So a major problem actually is that everything appears to be a little bit too depleted, and the only, we're not seeing the material that should be in the mantle to balance this stuff that should be over on the other side so that the average mantle can be here. Now, one place a little bit of that could be is underneath the continents. Another place it could be is if you have a dense layer down there that's actually enriched or something. This, by the way, is the latest compilation of the bulk crust values. Okay, here's neodymium. They've got 20 ppm on this model and 16 ppm in that model. And the numbers like 27 and 45, I mean, the French group used a number like 45 ppm for the crust at one point. I mean, there are rocks that are that high, but these are not likely for the bulk crust. The lower part of the crust is more. The Kellogg idea was, I guess I can do it in a minute. Basically, they were thinking about, rather than saying, well, this we're just going to worry about the average value in here. They're going to worry about all the details. And in their model, every time they do something like they transfer material to the crust, they make a box of a particular size that's left in the depleted mantle that's depleted at that time, and has a change in its samarium to neodymium ratio or RBSR ratio. And then they say that with time that box gets deformed by the flow, and the idea is that it gets strung out into a sheet, and the only important dimension is the thickness of the sheet. And the thickness of the sheet goes like e to the minus t over a stirring time. This was another possibility, but they didn't use this one. And then later on, when you sample the mantle, they just say, what's the probability you're going to sample, if you take a particular sampling volume, what's the probability, what's the likely value for the isotope ratio as a function of the sampling volume and as a function of the stirring time? And they go through the how to do the statistics, okay? But basically, this is what they come up with, is that this is what they get for the epsilon value distribution if you have a small sampling length that looks like this, and as you go to larger and larger sampling scales, it tightens up, and you get the exact value plus 10. However, the reason they got plus 10 is that they fudged it, and they used only, in their melting model, they used only melt fractions that were tiny. Less than, you remember I said that if you use big melt fractions, you generate high SMND ratios, and then you get these really high epsilon values later on. So to take care of that, they just say, okay, we'll just use a small melt fraction, but they didn't justify that. You want to answer that?
I think the turbulence, it's not the turbulence that you define in GANs. There's different concepts for high rating number fluid. True turbulence, which is for higher number flow and non-laminar flow. And the turbulence you can call thermal turbulence, which is has to do with the time dependence of the flow and how effective it is at stretching and folding. Okay, so in the laminar time scale that they had there for stirring and stretching and folding is for a very simple flow. And so you can define, you know, depending on the viscosity contrast between the fluids, how things thin out. And that depends only on the very simple stirring rates. If you have very time-dependent flow, you no longer have simple cells. And so you can get stuck in regions where basically there's no deformation, and in regions where there's a lot of deformation. It's unfortunately comes from the fluid dynamical literature that there are these two concepts of turbulence. One that's not that has nothing to do with the flow being high rate. So and
but just along the same lines, this is a picture of a calculation that's in the paper by Van Kecken and others showing if you take the Australian Indian plate and the steady state mixing model and let it go for 1 to 4 billion years, what happens to it? And you can see that it becomes dispersed into the entire mantle essentially. But from the standpoint of what you're going to do when you sample it by melting and making a basalt, you still didn't do anything to it. It's still there. Okay, it's little and it's been spread around, but you're still going to be able to see it because at the scale you're going to sample this later on, it's still, you know, definitely a discrete entity. Okay, almost done. All right. Yeah. The other, you know, problem is the uranium and thorium, the helium, and I just better not get started on that. So there's the models for that. So basically my problem with this view of the Earth is this. If you want to get OIBs, ocean island basalts, from this stuff down here and end up with this value, and all this material up here be the mid-ocean ridge reservoir, which is going to give you this distribution, you can't do it because it doesn't add up, basically. If you don't have anything that's on the other side of the bulk mantle here, really. So we did the calculation for how big the Morb reservoir should be if there's no other depleted reservoir. Here you've got another reservoir that's effectively depleted with regard to epsilon ND. So that means you have to shrink the Morb reservoir, not make it bigger, because if you've got some other, you're taking up some of the depletion somewhere else, the Morb reservoir has to be even smaller. Okay.
How about the mantle value? What is that based on?
That's the 2.5 times chondrites. Which went up from When I originally did the calculation, I'd used 1.5 times chondrites because I figured the bulk earth was chondritic, but now people have decided the bulk earth is enriched in refractory elements relative to chondrites. So it's now 2.5, but okay. So that's why, you know, I drew this cartoon this way because I'm not sure how much of this highly depleted stuff we have. I'm not sure there's enough to fill the upper mantle, let alone fill 2/3 of the mantle or something like that. And obviously this will be a topic for discussion if we are on this topic next week, but that's the way that I see it. I better leave it there. Sorry I took so long.